You're listening to Dig Deep on Northern Community Radio. I have joining me in the studio Minnesota Brown blogger Aaron Brown. He's our liberal commentator. Chuck Marone from Strong Towns, our conservative commentator. Today our topic is jobs and work. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here, Heidi. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm very happy too. Thank you.
Well, I think we'll begin talking about kind of the history of jobs, and we're talking specifically history of jobs here, where we live in northern Minnesota. How do we begin this conversation?
Well, of course, a billion years ago.
I was going to say, are we going to start with the world's oldest profession?
Yeah, yeah. No. Even before that, Chuck, a distant star exploded, sending out iron into the universe, which formed along with other elements into our planet. And some of that iron ended up right here in northern Minnesota. And so, for example, we can use iron ore on the iron ranges of northern Minnesota. And, of course, we can talk about timber and wood products that have also attracted development in this area. And then the fact that the region was, even before European settlement, was considered a bountiful place for hunting and gathering food. So we can really look at northern Minnesota and say, you know, resources drew people here, and it became a place where people thrived in different societies over many thousands of years. And more recently, the modern history, I guess you'd say, people came here in great numbers because of both the timber and then later the mines and then the other economic activities that spun off of that, manufacturing, building things, making things, all of that happening here in northern Minnesota. And so in 1890, there was no IRRRB. There was no economic development authority in any of the little ramshackle towns you found. And yet we had economic development because there was so much work to be done that they were calling for people to come here and work. And then they needed people cheap and they needed people expendable. So they got a lot of immigrant labor at that time. So that's the initial history of boom towns, you know, of northern Minnesota. Boom towns, and whether it was mining or whether it was the railroad expanding or whether it was farming and, you know, shipment of goods, all of that was a reason for a town to form quickly, for people to populate that town, and for people to start making some money. And then looking at beyond the job that brought them there, but at, you know, there's community and their aspirations for perhaps a better life than the difficult jobs that initially were here. And so that's our history. And now it's not like that anymore. And so now, you know, we watch as different technology took over. You know, there was initially the Industrial Revolution, which changed agriculture. And then you got out of the Industrial Revolution with all of this manufacturing capacity, which also created a lot of jobs. And then ever since, and at an exponentially greater rate, technology has improved so that fewer people are necessary to do the exact same amount of physical work. From the strict definition of work, things getting done and productivity, we've watched as, you know, technology has changed the nature of work all the way through World War II and then beyond. And then I think another big turning point was the late 70s, early 1980s. And then now, since 2000, 21st century, we've seen information technology, again, radically reform the workplace and what people do for money. And here we are in northern Minnesota, a place that was built not on somebody's idea to move here, but on somebody's discovery that there was work to be done here. And now we're in a world where that's old news, and we're trying to figure that out.
It's interesting because the dynamics of the boomtown, the actual like underlying economics still exists today in many ways. You had, in a sense, capital being brought in exchange for the resources that were being mined and sent out. And there was this supply of capital within the community. And then the community kind of oriented around how do we, in a sense, keep or retain or deploy this capital here as much as we can. So, for example, you had people who worked in the mines and they would get paid directly by this capital. But then what would happen to their paycheck? They would have to go get their haircut, or they would need to go buy food, or they would need to partake in some entertainment or whatever it was. These all created, in a sense, like local opportunities for people. And so you saw people moving to these boom towns to do all kinds of things, from putting on plays, which was an actual like profession back in the day, right? You could live being an entertainer, to opening the saloon, to opening the barber shop or the dentistry or whatever you were going to do. And so the idea was that the place would kind of grow or shrink, and the jobs associated with that would grow or shrink based on that capital exchange. You see a lot of times when there was a boom town, kind of famously around gold or something like that, where people would go long distances and get there and set up their mining, their little, you know, gold panning operation. But you would have this whole like ecosystem economy that would come with it for all these other kind of ancillary jobs. And as soon as the gold rush kind of dried up, everything else withered along with it. So the history of this part of the world is really about, first of all, that extraction, not just mining, which was a huge part of it, but also timber, and to a lesser degree, the extraction involved with agriculture. And then being able to use that capital that came in to build this broader set of jobs and disciplines and other things that would support a community and support a town created a lot of opportunity for people who wanted to move here. It was one of the reasons why we drew so many people in such a short period of time.
This is Dig Deep on Northern Community Radio. We're member-supported radio. We need your support, whether you're listening on the radio, on our website, kaxc.org, or you subscribe to the podcast. Let us know that conversations like what you're hearing between Aaron Brown and Chuck Marone on jobs is important. Become a member. Chuck Marone was speaking there, looking at jobs, why people came to the area for jobs in our history. He and Aaron are continuing this conversation on jobs. Aaron, of course, is the blogger of Minnesota Brown, and Chuck Marone, founder and CEO of Strong Towns. Aaron takes the liberal side, Chuck the conservative. Here's Aaron with more.
It's a good reminder that America is not a very old country, and that until the lifetime of some people who are still alive, it was still an expansionist country where the thought of, you know, what do you do if this mine plays out or if this timber operation goes under, the answer, you know, when my ancestors moved from Cornwall, England, which was a mining area, to Canada, and then followed mining operations through the Upper Peninsula of Michigan here and then to the Mesabi Iron Range, these people just moved and followed the work, and there was always more stuff being opened and expanded. And we're now coming to a, at least as a country, as a nation, to a maturity point where there's nowhere to expand. This idea of expansion, and it came with all kinds of problems too, especially for Native people. But for all of that mindset that a person could just follow the work all the way to the ocean, you know, now we've been to the ocean and back a few times. And so the idea that if the mine plays out, you got somewhere to go isn't there anymore. If the mine plays out, you go learn coding. You know, this is the problem people have now. Like, what do you do?
Well, I do think, too, in focusing on those early boom towns,
yeah,
I think there was a mindset that you could have where, how do I be useful to the people around me? And, you know, you had people who worked in the mines and they were getting deployed with this capital. But then this whole other kind of ecosystem grew up around of people who really were able to say, like, how do I be useful to people around me? And, you know, we nostalgize this a little bit. The store clerk who gets their start at the nickel and dime and then winds up 30 years later owning the place. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think we romanticize this a little bit. But yet it was also based on the reality that if you wanted to roll up your sleeves and work, and you had a mindset of how do I be helpful to the people around me, you could turn that into, in kind of Adam Smith's economic dream, of, you know, a really good way of living. A lot of that has vanished in the sense that, you know, if you decided today, I want to be real helpful to the people around me by selling something, well, there's a whole, you know, there's a whole like set of obstacles you'd have to overcome.
What's your web address?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and not only that, but I mean, you're competing with Walmart and Target. And you know, I want to be useful to the people around me by selling hamburgers. Well, I just drove into town. There's five like fast food hamburger joints that you can go to. I mean, you've got kind of an ante now to cross that hurdle as well. So these early places in terms of like employing raw numbers of people, there's a lot of work to be done. There was a lot of ways that we could be helpful to each other because we, you know, these things weren't there. And it created an enormous amount of employment opportunities for people. A lot of that has faded, and it just faded because of, in a sense, you could say, the maturity of our economy. But it's also faded in many ways because of how we've structured our economy.
You mentioned capital. I think that's such a huge deal. And there's a great story from Iron Range history about what capital really meant at those early days. You know, we have the story, and I know we've told it on the Great Northern Radio Show, and it's part of Iron Range lore, but the Merritt brothers, the people who discovered iron ore on the Mesabi Iron Range, this rich, beautiful Mesabi iron ore that was so good they didn't even recognize it because it was better than anything that existed. So this beautiful iron ore, these brothers, all hardy pioneer timbermen and entrepreneurs, hardworking as all heck, and they start mining this ore. And their story is a story of trying to raise capital. That's really what it was. They had access to the ore. They had people out there mining it, but they didn't have a railroad. They didn't have a way to transport it to the mills where they could sell it. And so it was a race, and ultimately a fruitless race, against big corporations that were able to raise money, able to invest in railroads, and who ultimately, like Daniel Day-Lewis in the oil movie, There Will Be Blood, they drank their milkshake. So the Rockefeller came in and basically squeezed them out with his widely available capital and ended up owning, him and Carnegie owned the Iron Range and made, you know, modern New York out of the proceeds with this enormous story of capital. So talking about the romanticization, the Merritt brothers are still celebrated. There's Merritt Days in Mountain Iron to this day. They bring in, you know, late 90s bands that were very popular, and they have Merritt Days. And the story of these brothers is the story of the Iron Range, but ultimately those guys got busted, broken by the fact that they didn't have capital. And I think this capital did come in with the Rockefellers, and it took a long time to balance out people's needs, workers' needs, and the corporation's desires. And eventually there was a whole process in our history of doing that. But it was the capital. Without the capital, there would be no Iron Range. The reason the ore wasn't mined before is because no one paid. They were aware of it in the 1830s, and then no one came until the 1880s and 90s because no one had the money or had the wherewithal to put the money in. So flash forward, it's still that way. It's the fact that the capital has dried up. The capital is now, people want big returns, but they're very cautious. There's no company more cautious than a mining company about expending capital right now. And that's because they've been burned literally to the ground in many cases by bankruptcies. And so where's the capital to go into that community to create the jobs? Because there's lots of work to do, lots of problems, lots of things we could solve. Wouldn't it be great if there was a place for kids to go and have fun? Young people could have a cool club hangout place. We could have a mini golf course and a go-kart track. We could do all this great stuff, but where's the money? Where's the money? And so right now, that's, you know, they can work. I got lots of work I can do, but what's going to pay? And that's where the job, the unit of the job, comes in, the modern discussion. And how do you create paying jobs for people?
That's Aaron Brown. It's Dig Deep on Northern Community Radio. We're 91.7 KEXE, 90.5 KBXE. You can listen to us all across northern Minnesota and anywhere in the world through the National Public Radio News app or through our podcast available through iTunes. I'm Heidi Holton. I'm News and Public Affairs Director at Northern Community Radio. It is my pleasure to sit down with these guys, with Aaron and Chuck, pose questions, just give ideas, and then they roll. We're talking jobs today. Aaron will continue the conversation. We're looking for your pledge of support. This is independent media, a national public radio affiliate in a rural area. You're not going to find it many places else, and you're not going to find conversations like this many other places. So pledge your support now. Call us at 800-662-5799. Chuck Marone talking now from Strong Towns about the transition from going to where there was work to be done and jobs to be found to moving into government having a hand in job creation.
The interesting part of this transition to from the early mining days to today, where our obsession is on jobs and job creation, and we have, you know, this aggressive kind of federal and state role in job creation and this kind of shared responsibility, is that, you know, back in the early mining days, nobody obsessed about creating jobs. We didn't look to government with an expectation of job creation because jobs just happened. I mean, they just created themselves. Like, literally, there was so much to do. And if things dried up in one spot, you moved on to another. We experienced a really deep recession in this country in the 1870s. It was largely a land speculation. The railroads went out and kind of overbuilt themselves. And we wound up in this recession. When you look at that recession, unemployment never got all that bad. People were able to essentially move on to the next spot and coalesce and find places where they could, like I said, be useful to each other. It was only when we went through these kind of the second industrial, the early industrialization, and hit what in hindsight we look at as the Great Depression, where we actually saw the kind of productivity gains and changes in how we did stuff stalled out, you know, helped stall out our economy. And we started to have this conversation about what's the role of a job? What does it mean to have a job? How do we best create jobs? Mm-hmm. And what is the government's role in ensuring that we have employment for people?
This is Jane Jacobs in Dark Days Ahead, Dark Age Ahead. You know, I know one of your favorite authors, Chuck. Yeah. I only read the one book recently, but she talks about the Great Depression forever changing the mindset of government as it relates to jobs and the mindset of everybody relating to jobs, because for the first time really in American history, when those jobs went away and when everybody was laid off, when there was no work, people had nowhere to go but to subsist, you know, off land. And it shocked the culture that had been expanding for all this time for the 100 in some year history of the United States. And then World War II happened, which was this great, almost a distraction from the Depression. It kind of emerged and gave a kind of a hasty end to the Depression that probably wasn't where the Depression was going to end. And then we were left with this shock to our system, not only of the big war, but also of this big economic storm that changed the country. And ever since 1950s on, you start to see a totally different approach and a thought process regarding jobs in our society. The idea that you have to cultivate them and keep them and protect from being ended or taken away, and these incentives started happening. And it was, I guess, a reasonable response to the terrors and horrors of the Depression and the war, but it kind of eliminated that idea that we had this natural, inexhaustible source of work for people. And I don't know that we've necessarily figured it out yet.
Yeah, well, the economic theories of that came out of the Depression essentially said that we can keep employment, we can get jobs going if government's willing to step in and essentially counteract the business cycle. As we got through industrialization, the business cycle became more volatile, more violent in a sense, the larger swings. And economists in the early 1900s were very obsessed with how do we stop this from essentially just wrecking things every time it goes one way or the other, you know, either a big, huge boom or a massive bust. And so you have the Federal Reserve, you have the federal government adopting economic policies now to try to even this out. by the time you get out of the Second World War, we had pretty much established the mindset that we were going to be able to do this at a macro level. And we began suburbanization. We began the horizontal expansion of cities. And we essentially began this kind of multi-generation long period of increasing productivity and increasing globalization as a way to essentially create jobs and increase standard of living. The impact of that, to me, is the fascinating thing, because if you look back at the literature of the time, the economists actually knew that this would mean less work to be done. They actually understood that, you know, when you automate things, that's going to mean that there's going to be fewer jobs. But they didn't believe that it would mean what it's come to mean, which is, you know, a lot of people unemployed or underemployed. What they thought it would mean is that now, instead of working a 40-hour week, you would work a 20-hour week, and you would have 20 extra hours to sit in front of your TV and learn Greek, which is what they thought like the TV would be for, right? Like teaching cultural things. They thought you'd be able to take an extra class at college and enlighten yourself, or volunteer at a civic organization. They thought that this would lead to like a flowering of humanity, like a great leap forward. And instead, what it's meant is this huge gap between the people who are doing well and the people who are not.
This is Dig Deep. We're talking jobs and work. In our next segment, we'll be talking more about the present of jobs.